You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot in the news today, a lot for us to talk about today as we go into Anything Goes Friday. But it being Friday, it is Brunch with Bernie for our first hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. I like to think of him as America's senator. Of course, when I lived in Vermont, I thought of him as my congressman. Now he's a senator. And I know the good people of Vermont are very, very pleased and very proud to have him as their senator. His website is sanders.senate.gov, and he will be taking your calls here for the next hour on this National Town Hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, 866-987-THOM. Senator Sanders.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here with us. A lot of things in the news in general. The FEMA relief battle seems to have resolved.
Let me just kind of,
Just go right through.
Okay. I know that in Vermont, New Jersey, North Carolina, or other states, people are worried about disaster relief. And what we're dealing with is, for the first time in the modern history of this country, we have our right-wing extremist friends who are saying that when disaster strikes, we're not going to provide emergency relief. We want to, quote-unquote, offset it. We want to have a major debate about whether we cut education or Medicare or whatever before we can come up with money to help rebuild communities. And I think that is an outrage for a dozen different reasons, not to mention the kind of precedent that it establishes. Can you imagine a major, major disaster in this country, and instead of getting the relief that those communities need, we have this ongoing debate? I should also mention, of course, that when it came to bailing out Wall Street or expanding the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan or giving tax breaks to the rich, these very same people had no problem. There were no offsets at that point.
Right.
So we are working hard. We got $2.65 billion more for FEMA, which should take us to mid-December. But there's no question that we're going to have to put more money into the Department of Transportation to rebuild roads and so forth and so on. So that's one issue that many of us are working hard on. A second issue, I know a lot of concern to people who listen to the show, the status of Social Security. I think this has been a fight that I have been waging, along with many others in Congress, you know, as chairman of the committee to defend the caucus that defends Social Security in the Senate. And we've been up and down on this issue. I think right now we're in a reasonably good place. The president, who in the past has talked about making cuts in Social Security, has backed off those cuts. And I think because millions of people have said, Mr. President, you were not elected to make cuts in Social Security. You were elected to strengthen Social Security. And I think the Obama administration has been hearing that message. So they've backed off. That's a good thing. We still have our right-wing Republicans who would like to, in some ways, destroy Social Security completely, but I think they are now in a strong minority. So I think we are making some progress, but we have to be vigilant on that. As I mentioned in the past, I've introduced legislation with 9 co-sponsors that would lift the cap on taxable payroll taxes above $250,000. And if you did that, you would have Social Security be solvent for the next 75 years. That would take care of the problem completely. And we're getting a lot of support around the country on that issue, because I think people understand it does not make a lot of sense that a multimillionaire pays the same amount into the Social Security Trust Fund as somebody making $106,000. So we're making progress on that. We got to stay vigilant, but I think at this moment at least, we may have pushed back successfully on cuts in Social Security. On the other hand, I worry about what's happening to Medicare. I just read in the front page of the Boston Globe today that the American Hospital Association is trying to put pressure on Congress to raise the retirement eligibility age for Medicare from 65 to 67. And that would be an unmitigated disaster for senior citizens in this country. Tom, just try to imagine being 66 years of age, of modest income, coming down with cancer, being diagnosed with cancer, and not having health insurance at all.
Yeah.
It is unspeakable, unacceptable, and we've got to remain focused on that issue and make sure that those cuts do not take place in Medicare.
Why would the Hospital Association want to raise that?
Well, because they feel that they are subsidizing Medicare right now. So if you are 65, every person who comes into Medicare right now, they feel they are expending more than they're getting.
Mm.
So if they can keep people out of Medicare for a few years, they see that as a savings. But all of this speaks to the fact that we have a dysfunctional healthcare system, the most wasteful and bureaucratic in the entire world, one that ends up spending almost twice as much per person on healthcare as do the people of any other country. And that speaks to the need, really, of a Medicare for all single-payer system, which is the most cost-effective way to provide health care to all people, something we are working on in Vermont and I'll continue to work on in Washington. But that's what they are pushing for, and other people have been pushing for that as well.
Sure.
Essentially, well, as I've said, it would be a disaster for many seniors. Now, there's something that's very interesting that's going on another subject, and that is the demonstrations taking place in New York City on Wall Street. And I'm not quite clear what the demands there are.
They have none so far.
Pardon me?
They have none. There are no specific demands. They simply want to call out. We've been doing a daily report from there and have had people on the ground there reporting. And, in fact, they've created a little community that's very democratically run, and they have decided not to have any demands,
well,
at least at this point, other than to point out
what I think is important
that they're speaking for the bottom
99%. Focusing attention on Wall Street is very, very important because
yes.
At the end of the day, in my view, we're not going to get out of this recession, this horrendous recession where 25 million people have no jobs, where wages are going down, unless we do focus on Wall Street. But also, I think it's important that we begin to raise some demands. I mean, all of us know that as a result of the enormous amounts of money Wall Street put into Congress in their successful effort to deregulate Wall Street, we ended up with the collapse, financial collapse, which led to this terrible recession. I think that unless we really bring about very, very strong Wall Street reform, I think we're not going to have the kind of economy that we desperately need. Some of the issues I think we should be focusing on is the reality that right now, hard to believe, the top six financial institutions in this country have assets of over 60%, 60% of the GDP in America. Isn't that incredible?
That is mind-boggling. Yeah.
Six institutions.
Six banks, basically.
Six banks. You know, Bank of America, JP Morgan, Chase, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. These six major financial institutions control 60% of the assets of the United States. So that's bad for two reasons. Number one, I have no doubt in my mind that the day will come again when they'll be in a position where they're about to collapse and they're going to go to Congress and say, we're too big to fail, you're going to have to bail us out again. And number two, just from a competitive perspective, who thinks it's a good idea that six institutions have that much economic and political power over the nation in terms of issuing credit cards, issuing mortgages, and we've got to, in my view, break them up. We've got to break them up and bring some serious competition to the financial industry. Second of all, we've got to demand that there be a cap on credit card interest rates, which go up to 25-30% today, which is, in my view, usury. Thirdly, we've got to take a hard look at the Fed. One of the provisions that I managed to get into the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill called for an audit of the Fed, and we learned that the Fed provided $16 trillion in low-interest loans to financial institutions and corporations in America and around the world. And that's just unbelievable. We've got to use the Fed to help deal with unemployment rather than just bail out Wall Street.
Well said. Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, right back with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with your calls for Senator Bernie Sanders in our national town hall meeting. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov.
When I hear the music play and I hear the children sing, I know together anything is possible. Time won't slip away, we'll give them all that life can bring, and I know together anything is possible.
20 minutes past the hour, talk media for the rest of us. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, our national town hall meeting. Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. George in Chicago. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you very much for taking my call, gentlemen. It's a pleasure and a privilege to speak to two such outstanding defenders of freedom. We're all familiar with the effort that's going on in the Congress right now to undo some of the damage that's been done to the Postal Service and its workers by the 2006 Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act. I hope I've got that title correct.
You do.
And as we all know, it was passed in the lame duck session of the Congress in 2006 after the Democrats had retaken both houses, and it was signed into law by President Bush. Now, a caller to the Ed Schultz show earlier this week recounted that this bill was passed by a unanimous voice vote in the House and by unanimous consent in the Senate. And I would simply like to ask Bernie if this was indeed the case, and if so, why did the Democratic leadership allow this to happen?
This was the bill that requires them over a 10-year period to fund retirement health benefits for a full 75 years, which is why the post office is broke right now. According to Ralph Nader, there would be a $1.2 billion surplus had it not been for this Republican poison pill, basically.
The caller, George, asked a very good question, and George, I don't know the answer to that question, but this is what I will tell you. We are going to do everything we can to defend the post office, which I think is a very, very important national institution, especially in rural areas. We're going to do everything we can to make sure that 100,000 workers are not laid off and that post offices in rural America are not shut down and that we continue to have six-day delivery. In fact, we're going to be meeting on Thursday in my office in D.C. with leaders of the unions and other people very knowledgeable about the post office to work on legislation, which I will introduce as soon as possible to strengthen the post office. And as Tom indicates, the issue here is that in two areas, the Postal Service has been paying out substantially more money for future retiree health benefits than they should be paying. In another instance, when the Post Office went from being a government agency to a independent agency, self-sufficient, it turns out that they are contributing a lot more, or asked to contribute a lot more to the pension plans, government pension plans, than they should have. So I think we have to deal with these accounting issues and make sure that the Postal Service gets back the money that they have overpaid. We also have to give them the tools to compete in the 21st century. There's legislation out there which actually limits what a post office can do, as opposed to other countries like France, which give them a lot more flexibility to respond to consumer needs. So there's a lot of work to be done, but I happen to believe the post office is a very, very important institution in this country. I think we can make it financially self-sufficient, and I'm going to be working very hard on that.
Okay. Is it Cheryl or Shirley in L.A.?
Cheryl.
Cheryl, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi there. Hey, Senator Sanders, I just had a question for you about the domestic use of drones, and I think it's really important today after the assassination that the United States did yesterday. And I saw a ticker on the news just now that we assassinated three people in Pakistan, too, last night with those drones. And so my local paper is the L.A. Times, and a couple weeks ago we had a long article in there that I call a thank you for smoking article that those lobby groups put out like it's a news release, and then it just gets run. And the gist of the article was that drones are really good for us and that they could be used for lots of things besides military. And this article claimed that, because I know we've had some on the border that I assume they're Homeland Security drones on immigration that I assume are used by some contractors. I don't know. But this article claimed that they had moved them last year over Texas to track the wildfires. And then scarier to me was they had moved, this article claimed that they had moved them up towards Minneapolis along the Mississippi during the spring flooding to track the flooding. And that we could start using those drones everywhere for stuff like that because it would be so helpful to us as a society. And so I just wanted to know if you could look into that and see if they were really moved around. I just think it answers a lot of questions of who's in charge of those drones. Could Homeland Security just move them around and are they flying over us now? Could we know? Okay, LAPD, could LAPD just get a grant and have some drones flying over us?
Okay, let me just respond by saying I don't know the answers to your question, Cheryl, but it is an issue worth looking into. But here's the overall issue. Drones, like other forms of technology, certainly can be used in a way to really eviscerate the privacy protections that the American people want. And I have been very concerned for a number of years that with the explosion of GPSs, the explosion of all kinds of camera surveillance, that we are a nation in which people are monitored a whole lot more than they think they should be. On the other hand, are there good uses for things like drones to monitor where fires are so the firefighters can be more effective in putting it out? Yes, there are. But it's a question of controlling technology in a way that preserves privacy rights in this country. And that is a huge, huge issue, which, in fact, we will be involved in.
And so you expect legislative act. We have about 50 seconds here. You expect legislative action moving in the direction of maybe not even just drones, but beyond that, of protecting our privacy in the United States?
You know, if you go out, there's no question that with GPSs and everything else, we are monitored in an unprecedented way.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that is something we have to take a hard look at.
Okay. Well said. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Sanders taking your calls at 866-97-THOM. And you check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
More of Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program, 27 minutes past the hour. Sanders.senate.gov. Sign up for his Bernie Buzz newsletter. Where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Bernie, you're still with us?
Right here.
Okay. John in Dallas, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, hello, Tom and Bernie. Thanks for taking my call. I want us to remember back in 2001 when we had this surplus, we said that we would use some of it to spend on paying down the debt, and then most of it we had to return because we had overcharged people. We were going to give them a tax credit, but that was not a good idea because they needed to have more planning. So he said, well, we'll have a more permanent one by putting in a tax rate decrease. And if you remember, one of the senators from Maine said, well, what happens if we don't get the surplus? Maybe we should put a trigger in. Everybody said, oh, no, it's impossible. We can see that this is going to last forever. So they finally agreed that they would put it for 10 years because I guess that's Congress's definition of what forever is. So therefore, the thing is that when we let the Bush tax cuts expire and go back to the 2000 tax rates, what we're really doing is we are finally admitting that we don't have a surplus and it is not a tax increase.
Well, John, I think, you know, you make an obvious and good point, and that is that what happened during the Bush era is the president decided to provide huge tax breaks, a significant amount of which went to the very, very wealthiest people in this country who have already been doing extremely well, and at the same time, and in an unprecedented way, the president went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So we went into two wars, and instead of paying for those wars, which we did not, we ran those up on the credit card. We said, oh, by the way, we're going into two wars at huge expense, and then we're going to give tax breaks, including hundreds of billions of dollars to the wealthiest 2% in America. When you do that, when you bail out Wall Street, when you pass a Medicare Part D prescription drug program and you forget to pay for that, it ends up that you're going to have a huge deficit, and that is exactly what happened. So my view is, obviously, we have got to end the tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country who are doing phenomenally well, who do not need those tax breaks, use that money for deficit reduction, and
end to start investing in America, in our energy system, in our infrastructure, to create the millions of jobs we desperately need.
Okay. Kevin, in Wilmington, Vermont, you're on the air with your senator.
Hello, Bernie. Kevin Downey here.
How you doing, Kevin? How's Wilmington doing?
Well, we're making progress. There's a few restaurants and businesses that are open on Main Street. However, mine being one of them, we're still waiting on insurance and other stuff, and some buildings may still be lost. But that's not the point I'm calling for, Bernie. It's kind of related. I wrote an email to Governor Shumlin the other day and CC'd you and Senator Leahy and Congressman Welch about a possible avenue for jobs. Flood control was my subject, and we desperately need flood control in this town. And my suggestion was that all these small rivulets that feed the Deerfield River here in town, and this can go for any river, major river in the state, but the Deerfield River rivulets, if we were to make small powerhouse, build dams on these small rivulets that feed the Deerfield and put powerhouses on them, we could not only create jobs, we could create flood control, and we could generate electricity all at the same time, sir.
Kevin, I think that that's a very excellent idea. It's an interesting idea. For everybody else, Kevin is in Wilmington, Vermont, which is probably the community in the state of Vermont that was hardest hit, really devastated. I was down there after the flood hit, and it was just incredible to see what happened to their downtown and to a number of their businesses. And what Kevin is saying, which is certainly true for Wilmington, it's true for Vermont, it's true for America, is that if we do some flood control, which is part of what I call, in a broader sense, infrastructure, so that we don't have these devastating floods that cause so much damage every few years, we can put people to work in a very productive way. And Kevin's point here is not only can you control the damage of floods, but in this case, you may be able to have some hydro electricity production, which to me makes a whole lot of sense. But the broader issue that Kevin is talking about, I think, is not only flood control, not only generating hydroelectricity, but is rebuilding our infrastructure so that we become more productive, more internationally competitive, and we create over a period of time millions and millions of jobs. So I think Kevin is coming from the right place.
Russell in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Greetings.
Hi.
Well, Senator Sanders, we have a problem. For all of us who believe in single payer, in civil liberties, in taxing the rich, we have a big problem, and his name is Barack Obama. I don't know if you saw Jonathan Turley's piece in the LA Times today on civil liberties, but he said that Barack Obama has been a disaster, not just for specific civil liberties, but the civil liberties caused in the United States. On single payer, he was against it from the beginning. And he muscled people like you and Kucinich to go along with him. On the Bush tax cuts, which you just talked about, they're now the Bush-Obama tax cuts because he went along with them. So I'm getting a little fed up with Democrats talking about these problems and not addressing this issue. What are we going to do about Barack Obama, who's perhaps, you know, one of the worst presidents of our generation?
Well, I think, Russell, you know, I would agree with some of what you said, obviously, as we have talked on the show a whole lot, in terms of Wall Street, in terms of the economy, in terms of taxes, in terms of civil liberties. The president has clearly been disappointing to many people and nowhere near as strong as we had hoped that he would be. I believe he ran one of the greatest campaigns that I've ever seen in my lifetime. He inspired people, galvanized people, brought people together. But for whatever reasons, he has not followed through with a lot of the issues that he discussed in his campaign, and I think has not stood up to the right-wing extremism that is so potent in Washington right now. And the answer is, what you're asking is, what do we do? Well, the only thing that I know to do is to rally the American people around the progressive agenda. I mentioned a moment ago that Obama was waffling on Social Security. He was talking about cuts in Social Security. Well, you know what? I think he has heard from large numbers of people, I don't know how many, all over this country who are saying, excuse me, Social Security has not contributed one nickel to the deficit. Do not cut Social Security. And you know what? He's not talking about that anymore. And we got to put pressure on him in terms of Medicare. We got to put pressure on him in terms of a strong jobs program. In the last couple of weeks, he has been sounding more progressive than he did a number of months ago. Is he saying what he should be saying? No. Is he making a step, going a step forward? I think he is. His jobs program, which talks about infrastructure, is good. We need more money into it. We need to rally the American people to understand that investing in energy, investing in infrastructure, asking the wealthy to start paying their fair share is what is not only morally right to do, but is what will get us out of this terrible recession. So, Russell, the only thing that I can say is what politics is about, what Democratic with a small d politics is about, is rallying the American people, making elected officials or candidates an offer they can't refuse. And that is, if they don't go forward, they're not going to get support.
Sherry in Oklahoma City, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. Hello, Senator Sanders. It's a pleasure to be able to listen to you and to ask you a question. I just heard about something the other day, and I don't know if it's correct or not. It was about an infrastructure bank where people can invest in that at approximately 5% return on their money. The money would be secured by the government, and the funds would be used to build our infrastructure. It would also serve to take some of the money away from Wall Street, where they cannot gamble with retirement funds and people's 401ks. Do you know anything about this?
Well, what I do know, Sherry, is there has been a lot of talk about an infrastructure bank. If my memory is correct, the president proposed putting $10 billion into that bank. The idea of the American people investing in that bank and getting a decent rate of return, I don't know what it would be, I think is a good idea. You're involving the American people. You're having them invest in something that's good for the country that will create jobs. So I think that is a sensible idea. So to answer your question, Sherry, I don't know all of the details, but yes, there is a lot of discussion about, A, investing in infrastructure, rebuilding America, B, and specifically an infrastructure bank.
It would be almost like when I was a little kid at school, we got these paper things where you could put quarters in periodically to buy ultimately bonds in the United States.
Exactly.
To help build
That's right. And I think that makes a lot of sense. It's a good way for people to invest that helps them rebuild our country and helps us move away from this terrible recession by creating good-paying jobs.
Yeah, and we just have 20 seconds to the break. Is no specific legislation that you know
of? Yeah, there is. I mean, there is John Kerry of Massachusetts introduced the concept. Others are talking about it, and it makes a lot of sense to me.
Great.
The fastest way to create jobs right now is to rebuild our infrastructure.
Yeah, put people to work. Absolutely. Senator Bernie Sanders with us on the line. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders in our national town hall meeting, the Brunch with Bernie Hour, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website over at sanders.senate.gov. A lot of great information. That's a great news source. True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls. Middleton in West Virginia, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Mr. Sanders.
Hello, Middleton. How are you?
Okay, you know, I'm calling from West Virginia, too, and that other guy that just called from Berkeley Springs,
yep.
He's a Republican. He wasn't talking about what you were saying. He was talking on the Republican side. He wasn't a Democrat.
Okay.
Yeah, and I want to make a comment. There's something that, do you know about, you know that the Chinese is buying up all the scrap in the United States, because I worked in a steel mill, I'm now retired, and we had to pay a big price for every bit of scrap we bought because the Chinese was getting it all.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure they're still doing it.
Cool.
You know, and that really hurts our manufacturers because they have to pay a big price
right.
for scrap, so that means they have to raise your price.
Well, Middleton, I think you're touching on a point that sometime, Tom, we should spend maybe a whole show on it, and that is the Chinese economy and what they are doing, the impact they're having on the United States, and how we can effectively compete against them. One of the issues that I feel very strongly about, and Tom and I have discussed this for years, is our disastrous trade policy with China and with other countries, which has enabled major corporation after major corporation, you name the company, General Electric, you name it, shut down in the United States and move jobs to China, and then we bring those products back tariff-free. Middleton talks about scrap metal, but we can amplify that in a dozen different areas. The Chinese government is doing what it can for its people, and that's their job. But I want to see the United States government begin to do what it can for its people, and that is that we have trade policies which protect American workers, do not just work for large CEOs, which are based on fair trade principles, not unfettered free trade principles. For years now, whether it's NAFTA, CAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China, we have had trade policies which have resulted in the loss of millions of good-paying jobs in this country. As I've mentioned before, in the last 10 years, my friends, we have lost 50,000 factories in America. Go out to your store today. Go out to your department store. See how many products you can purchase that are made in the United States of America. We are working very hard in my office trying to begin to reverse that. But it has everything to do with trade policies. It has everything to do with corporate welfare, which literally gives money, gives subsidies to corporations who are throwing American workers out on the street. So how we compete effectively against China, who, by the way, is investing 9% of its GDP in infrastructure, while we're investing 2%. They're building airports. They're building high-speed rail. We're not doing that because our Republican friends are more interested in giving tax breaks to billionaires than rebuilding our infrastructure. This is a huge issue, which has got to be dealt with if we're going to rebuild the middle class and create a decent economy here.
Jonathan in New York, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello?
Jonathan, you're on the air.
Yes. I have about the Dodd-Frank bill. During around that same time, there was a Return to Prudent Banking Act that would have also repealed Gramm-Leach-Bliley that allowed the banks to, allowed the bank to merge.
Right. You need to turn your TV or radio down because there is a time delay, Jonathan. It'll totally confuse you. So are you suggesting should we go back to Glass-Steagall?
Yes, Glass-Steagall and the Bank Holding Company Act.
Okay.
Well, I think as somebody who, when I was in the House, was a member of the Financial Services Committee and fought very, very hard against Alan Greenspan and that entire mentality of deregulation, in general, I agree with what Jonathan is saying. What you need to do is certainly re-regulate Wall Street. You have to end that highly speculative activity. What you have to say, if people want to speculate, let them speculate, but they're not going to have the government there to protect them and bail them out. On the other hand, what you need is a strong commercial bank system which says that when people put deposits into a bank, those banks are going to invest in small businesses, invest in our productive economy, and we are going to protect those banks, but they're going to be regulated. So in general, I certainly do agree with what Jonathan is saying, and which speaks to the need for real Wall Street reform. And again, I would suggest that when you have six major financial institutions controlling 60% of the assets of our GDP, then we need to start breaking those guys up as well.
Okay. Steve in Brattleboro, Vermont. We got about a minute and a half here. Quick question for Senator Sanders, for your senator.
Senator. I live in Brattleboro, and of course we're right there by the Vernon. And I understand that the United States government insures the nuclear power plants. If they're so interested in cutting the budget, why don't we cut that out?
Well, that's a very good point, Steve. What there is a provision. It's called the
Price-Anderson Act.
Price-Anderson Act. That's right. That's exactly right, Tom. And what Price-Anderson says, if God forbid there is a nuclear disaster, the industry will pick up a certain amount of the cost, but if it becomes too large, the United States government will be there to pick up some of that liability. Interestingly enough, our friends in the nuclear sector who you know, when we say, well, why don't you go to Wall Street? Why don't you go to the private insurance companies to get that insurance? The answer is they can't get it because the private insurance companies will not provide it to them because it's just too risky. So I think, I think that Steve, makes a very, very good point. And that's just one of the many ways, Steve, that the federal government, is promoting nuclear industry right now. These, some of my colleagues in the Senate want to have tens and tens of billions of dollars in loan guarantees for new nuclear power plants. But without the strong intervention of the federal government, I doubt that we would have much of a nuclear industry today at all.
Yeah. Bernie, last 20 seconds, 30 seconds, thoughts for our viewers and listeners?
Well, these are, I just would urge people to pay a lot of attention to what's going on in Washington right now. We have the supercommittee dealing with deficit reduction. Our demand has got to be that you do not balance the budget on the backs of the elderly, the children, the sick, the poor. There are ways to move toward deficit reduction by asking the wealthy, large corporations to stop paying their fair share, take a hard look at military spending. A lot of stuff, Tom, that's going on. I hope people pay attention.
Well said. Thank you, Bernie.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, I love this headline over at DU. Some kid in New York today is doing more for your future than any politician you voted for in 2008. I would say, you know, unless you live in Vermont and voted for Bernie Sanders, his website, Bernie.org, is really worth checking out. Bernie.org. Anyhow, a lot of the news. Anwar al-Awlaki was murdered today, was assassinated from the air by a drone by the Obama administration. No court proceedings. This baffles me because unless there was a secret court proceeding that someday we'll learn about or that that matched the laws of the United States in some way. The Fifth Amendment very clearly says that one of the things our government may not do, keep in mind the Constitution is mostly, it's not assertions of what the government should be doing, although there are other reasons why the government was created in the preamble of the Constitution. But it's mostly, as President Obama correctly said during the election and was ridiculed by right-wingers for, it's a bill of negative rights. In other words, what it does is it withholds the government from doing things. Like snooping on you in the Fourth Amendment, or like shutting you up, or stopping your right to have a demonstration in the First Amendment. Or in the Fifth Amendment, the government shall deprive no person of life without due process of law. In other words, killing you without a court hearing. And to the best of my knowledge, there was not one for this guy. And I'm just baffled by this. Let's assume that everything that they're saying about him is true. That he recruited the underwear bomber, that he'd been in contact with, Major Hassan, the guy, you know, the Fort Hood shooter, that he had been involved in a direct or peripheral way with the New York Times attempted bomber, that this is an American, by the way, a guy born in the United States. It seems that if all of these media stories are true, then there would have been enough evidence, there would have been enough to hold a trial and convict this guy in absentia in a federal court. The federal courts do have death penalty jurisdiction, sentence him to death, and then kill him. Now, I'm not a fan of the death penalty. This is one of those gray areas. If you're at war with somebody and they're trying to kill you, then, you know, war, the rules of war are somewhat different. And they do allow for killing. I consider war to be mass insanity, and I don't consider this to be a legitimate war. And frankly, I think that Anwar al-Awlaki would not even exist as a phenomenon had George Bush not responded to 9/11 by going nuts. But all that said, I can't figure out why this guy was assassinated without a court proceeding. And like I said, maybe, you know, time will tell. Maybe there was something. Or maybe America has now entered into the era where the President of the United States can order the execution of an American citizen anywhere in the world simply because he's the president of the United States. If that's what's going on, regardless of how bad the guy is, we've entered a very dangerous era. You know, we always see these laws passed, you know, laws to crack down on the internet, right? To basically snoop on all of us. The excuse, child porn. Well, who's going to defend that? And now it's, you know, the right of the president to kill anybody he wants. Well, this bad guy. I mean, look at all the things he did. Well, who's going to defend that? The problem is that when you establish laws and you set precedents and you establish policies based on the extreme get bad guys, over time, those creep into all kinds of other areas. And pretty soon, the average citizen gets dragged into them. And this is one of those areas where me, as both a progressive and a liberal, I think probably would be in complete agreement with Ron Paul. It'd be interesting to find out his position on this. But I'm guessing that he would say, you know, the Fifth Amendment. He's fanatic about the Constitution. The Fifth Amendment says no person shall be, no person, not even no citizen, no person shall be deprived of life without due process of law. That's the language right there, the Fifth Amendment. Cheyenne in Long Beach, California, listening on AM 1150. Hey, Cheyenne, what's up?
Yeah, I was just reading the Constitution the last couple of days, so that's the reason I called in, because it's like, well, okay, well, now I guess the police, you know, if they, you know, think you committed a crime, they should just get out, shoot you dead, and say, well, hey.
Well, in some communities in America, they've been doing that for a long, long time.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I grew up in the neighborhood, so I know how the police, you know, shoot people and make up everything later. And so obviously they became the judge, the jury, and the executioner all at once. So if people want to give the president that power, whether it's Barack Obama or President Bachman or President Perry, hey, you know what? When they do it to somebody in your family, Mr. Republican, don't complain. One other thing I want to ask you about.
Yeah.
How come nobody ever, either the senator that was just on, or you yourself, correct me if I'm wrong, how come people don't go into these Republican areas down in the South, in these areas, and figure out and say, well, how many people that live in these Republican districts that vote Republican, Eric Cantor and the rest of them, how many of them are actually on government assistance?
Yeah.
You know, what's the
well, Eric Cantor represents a part of Virginia that's actually quite wealthy, and in some of the poor states like Mississippi, you got Mary Landrieu, a Democrat, representing that. There's also a Republican, but you know, it's
this is my point. All of those states and those Republican areas, they all can be affluent.
No.
You know, there's certainly massive amount of
look at Texas.
I mean, but if you look, the people that's most represented as far as being on welfare or AFDC are white people. Mm. They're more. It's more them on quote welfare than any other ethnic group in the United States. But what I'm saying is, how come those people that's on welfare in those Republican areas, how come people don't point that out and say, well, look, how can you on one hand support these type of people, vote for them, when you yourself are government assistance?
Yeah, Sean, there's a larger question. There's a larger problem, and that is that by and large, those people don't vote. People who are on government assistance, you see a relationship. There is a clear relationship between a person's income and their probability of voting. And people who are making more than $50,000 a year, you know, up to millions and billions, or more than $70,000 a year, are highly likely to vote. People making between $50,000 and $20,000, moderately likely to vote. People making under $20,000, more likely not to vote. And we need to do something about that.
Okay, and I understand what you're saying. So, okay, let's take those people. Those people are voting against their own economic interests by voting for these same politicians.
Or by not voting.
Politicians. Or yeah, you're right. Or not voting.
Because not voting is a political act as well.
Yeah, exactly. So therefore, they're not getting a fair exchange for their vote because the people who they're voting for are killing their economic interests. And it's amazing that no Democratic politician speaks directly to those people and say, hey, you Republicans that vote for these people, you make X amount of dollars.
Yeah.
But the people who you vote for are economically killing you.
Yeah, well, one of the problems also, Shan, is that in a lot of these states and a lot of these areas, the Democrat that they're presented with is a blue dog, yellow dog, some kind of dog, super conservative Democrat who has been bought off by the oil interests in Louisiana, for example, or the Walmart interests in Arkansas. And so people know that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Which is why it's so important in every part of the country, and particularly in low-income areas, for people to get involved in the political process and show up. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting live coast-to-coast on commercial stations all across the United States, Europe, and Africa on Pacifica radio stations. Marilyn in France. Hey, Marilyn, thanks for calling. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about the White House We the People feature that is new on the WhiteHouse.gov site.
Right, where if 5,000 people vote for something, it will turn into an issue that the White House responds to.
Yeah, they've structured it as petitions.
Mm-hmm.
So you make a petition, and you have to get 150 people to sign on to that petition before it goes live on the site.
Right.
And so I thought, okay, I'll make a petition. I started with jobs because I think that's a big issue right now, and petitioned that we stop subsidizing offshoring and start rewarding, bringing good-paying jobs back to this country.
Mm-hmm. By this country, you are in France right now, right?
Sorry, back to the USA. I'm an American.
But you live and work in France?
I'm living in France. I'm semi-retired. Okay. I do my work in my little place, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, and I vote.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I made this petition, but I have to get 150 signatures before it goes live. And so I put it on your message board, and lots of people have looked at it, but two people of your community have signed on to it.
Aha. Uh-huh. So you need 150 signatures.
But I need 150 before it goes live on the site so that people just looking at the site will see it.
So, Marilyn, how do people find it on my message board? At TomHartman.com.
Well, I put it in two places, under the economy and under domestic politics on the message board.
Okay.
But then the next thing is that people can do this, too. They can petition. They can make a petition for Healthcare Part E, Medicare Part E or whatever. And there's a lot of really good petitions already on the site that people should know about and go and look at and sign on to.
Yep.
Like, ending corporate personhood and legalizing and regulating marijuana, all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, it would be good if recognizing Wall Street protesters, investigating Bush war crimes. There's petitions already there for those.
I was just going to say, I'm surprised that all of those topics haven't already floated up to the level of petition. Marilyn, what are the names of your posts over at TomHartman.com so our members and listeners can easily find them?
The White House, We the People.
That's the title? Okay, great. People
We the People is in it. I can't remember exactly, if they see We the People, they'll recognize it.
Okay, great. Marilyn, thanks.
Yeah, and I put it on Facebook, and like two people responded.
Right,
like,
I know.
What? Doesn't anybody care?
Well, did you build hot links into it so that people can easily just click and be there?
Yeah, I put the links there.
Great. So that's pretty important.
So,
well, you're doing everything right. You've plugged it for a minute and a half here on national radio. So hopefully that'll get the 150 signatures for you, Marilyn. Thank you for your.
Yeah, but I also hope that other people will make their own petitions.
Yes.
They can go to your
You still there? Oh, we have lost Marilyn. So much for talking to somebody in France. You know, I mean, long-distance phone calls, you never know. Marilyn, thank you for the call. Tony in Los Angeles. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Calling to talk about living in the police state.
Yeah.
I'm planning to go to Occupy LA tomorrow, and, you know, I've been victimized by police officers in the past where I've been threatened with violence. I mean, how can we, as an average person, I mean, there's nothing in the laws that protect us from defending ourselves from a physical attack police officer.
Right. Here's what Mahatma Gandhi pointed out, and I think he was so right about this, that, and this was his advice to his nonviolent protesters. I think it was called ahimsa, but there was an Indian word for it. And what he said was that the smallest violent act in response to the violence of the, I'm paraphrasing this, these are my words, not his, but he said this probably much more eloquently than me. But the smallest violent act by the protesters, by the demonstrators, by the resistors, in response to the violence of the state, is like a drop of arsenic in a glass of water. It turns it all bitter and all poisonous. If you are committed to nonviolence, you have to be absolutely committed to nonviolence. Like the people who followed Martin Luther King, and when they turned the dogs on them, they stood there. When they turned the hoses on them, they stood there. When they beat them to the ground, they fell to the ground. And you allow that brutality. Those women who were maced by the police, that police officer, Anthony Bologna, now is being vilified. Apparently the New York City Police Department is reinvestigating him. Apparently this isn't the first time he's done, not necessarily this exact same thing, but he had a civil rights violation filed against him in the 2004 Republican convention in New York City. And there were some, you know, rogue cops there, kind of reminiscent of 68 in Chicago. But had one of those women, you know, pulled out a knife and tried to throw it at him or even tried to punch him, frankly, that would have become the story rather than his pepper spraying them. There is great spiritual, moral, emotional power in pure nonviolence. And that's my advice, if I may.
Yeah. No, and I truly appreciate that. Definitely sheds a light on what we should be doing. I mean, I was just more calling about how, you know, you hear stories about cops who beat people, and if there's no...
Well, you have as many people videotaping the thing as you possibly can. I mean, that's number one, Tony. You want to archive this. Thank you for your call. We're out of time. But that's, you know, Rodney King would not be known to any of us were it not for videotape. Or nowadays, you know, chips.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And then get it on YouTube. But the commitment to nonviolence has to be absolutely unswerving if it's to work. Absolutely unswerving. Fun weekend, you know, or Friday rather. Friday, yeah, well, it's the beginning of the weekend. It's and Juba Mamadic and Shabbat Shalom and TGIF and all that kind of thing. But it's anything goes Friday. So, you know, whatever topics you want to talk about. Sean in Tennessee. Hey, Sean, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I saw some reports and stuff on the internet one day about the Federal Reserve, and it sounds to me like it's very wrongly named. Because it was stating that the Federal Reserve is, in fact, all the large banks in the world. And it sounded to me like we're just a bunch of puppets under the string of something like the Trilateral Commission.
Yeah, sort of. The Federal Reserve is not federal and it has no reserves, first of all. So it is inappropriately named. The Federal Reserve is a corporation that was created by charter of Congress in 1913. It is owned by its member banks, and there are either 10, 12, or 13. I forget. It's been a while since I read all the stuff on the Fed. For example, I believe that the first Federal Reserve Bank is the Bank of Boston. And then those banks, in turn, are sometimes owned by smaller banks. And the way that I first learned this, there's kind of a weird roundabout way, but it was back when we were living in Vermont before I was doing political talk radio. And I was banking with Chittenden Bank. And Chittenden, and we were, and I was sitting in the bank talking with the guy that you know, from the setting up accounts, and you know, the he's our, like, your local banker. This is a small town bank, right?
Right.
And he said, we're doing a special offering of stock if you'd like to invest in the Chittenden Bank. You know, our depositors get a preferred type of stock or a better price or some whatever the deal was. It was some kind of deal. And he said, Chittenden Bank is one of the owners of the Bank of Boston, which is one of the owners of the Fed. So indirectly, you're investing in the Federal Reserve Bank. And he said, this is a very solid investment. And, you know, this bank is has been around for decades and will be around for centuries. And we chose not to, but that got, you know, me scratching my head going, wait a minute, my local bank is one of the owners of the Federal Reserve Bank. And turns out it was, you know, I actually called the Federal Reserve in Boston and said, well, how does this work? And did some reading on it. And that got me reading the Monster from Jekyll Island, one of the first kind of anti-Fed books that was written about how the Fed came about. And there are others. The person who writes the most eloquently and brilliantly about this, I think, is Ellen Brown, who's been on this program a number of times. Her website is called Web of Debt, D-E-B-T, webofdebt.com, and which is also the title of her book, which is a very large tome. But we have a Federal Reserve Bank that is independent of our government, but half, or maybe it's half plus one or half minus one, of the members of the Federal Reserve Bank, plus the chairman of the Board of Governors, are appointed by our government, and the rest are appointed by the banksters. And so it's a private-public entity, and the desire when they set that up to make it that way was so that no government, if you had a corrupt government, if you had a George Bush kind of or Richard Nixon kind of president, they couldn't use the apparatus of a banking system that can create money out of thin air. They couldn't use that for political purposes. And on the other hand, that if you had corrupt banks, that there would be enough government in there that they could rein them in. And, you know, it was a good try. I genuinely think that when it was started, there some of the people involved had the best of intentions. Others were, you know, big banksters. And to some extent, it has brought us some stability. Most of the other major countries of the world had emulated this. Canada actually renationalized their Federal Reserve Bank for, I believe, 2 years, and then they reprivatized it again. And I don't know enough about exactly why they did the first and why they did the second to give you all the details other than to get you set on that trail. But that's pretty much most of what I know about it that I definitely know I know about it. Beyond that, and thank you for bringing the topic up, Sean. I encourage people to learn more about it. Bernie, as he pointed out, the Fed has never been audited since 1913 when it was created. That's wrong. And so Bernie Sanders proposed legislation that became part of the bailout bill during the Bush administration that forced the Fed, or maybe it was part of the stimulus package. Anyhow, it was a piece of legislation that forced the Fed to reveal an audit of that period of time, the 2008, 2009, 2010 period of time when the Fed was intervening in markets to keep the world from crashing. And it turns out that the Fed loaned out $16 trillion. Keep in mind, the GDP of the entire country of the United States is $15 trillion. They loaned out $16 trillion. They invented out of nothing $16 trillion and loaned it out to banksters and to other federal banks, many of them outside the United States. And there's a big, you know, what the hell is going on here question in the minds of a lot of members of Congress now. Dennis Kucinich has been on this forever. Ron Paul has been on this forever. Bernie Sanders has been on this forever. But most of the rest of them, not so concerned. Eric in New York City. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for all that you do. Can you hear me?
I can, and the thanks are not necessary. It's appreciated but not necessary, and takes up a lot of time. So what's up?
Okay. Well, I'm very excited to be able to give people a piece of really good news. The problem
Now I'm not hearing you, Eric. The what problem?
Election integrity problem, where election machines have been shown
across all different vendors to be incredibly not trustworthy.
Right, hackable machines, right.
Right.
Voting machines.
So it so happens that there's a wonderful Secretary of State in California, Deborah Bowen. You may
yes.
be very familiar
she
with her.
She has been on this program.
And she did a remarkable thing called the Top to Bottom Review a few years ago.
Yep.
Which really, you know, got to the heart of the problem with, no pun intended, Hart being one of the vendors. But you can call Deborah Bowen today, 916-657-2166, and tell her that she did an awesome thing with a top-to-bottom review, and tell her now the answer for how to address the problem of untrustworthy voting machines. She's now in a good position to actually move forward. It's called SOBA auditing, S-O-B-A auditing, and anyone can Google and see that there's a technical paper developed by a professor at Berkeley of Statistics and a group of other scientists
mm-hmm.
That explains how to create an auditing procedure that is so transparent
right.
that it makes it impossible for a purely electronic theft of an election to take place.
Well, that would be a marvelous thing, Eric, but let me tell you, in my mind, there's a far more fundamental problem, and that is that we have private corporations asserting the right of trademark and copyright privacy to the software in these machines, in some cases owning the machines and leasing them to governments, in other cases selling the machines to governments, but still owning the software. And I don't believe that the beating heart of an American democracy, the vote, should ever have been privatized. And frankly, I think we should go back to paper. I'll just leave, you know. But your point is well made, and you got it out there. Thank you very much for the call. Well said. Gene in Brattleboro, Vermont. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I will thank you for giving our junior senator a platform every week for so many months and years that you have. And,
oh, it's been 7 years now, and he's become the star of my show. He's doing
well,
great.
He's got a consistent message, that's yeah. for sure, and it needs to be heard.
Yeah, let me plug one more time, if I may, your senator's other website, which is bernie.org, which anybody who wants to support Bernie Sanders in his efforts to get reelected or in his political efforts. Bernie.org is the website to get to, and I know he's going to be facing a tough reelection coming up this next year and needs all the help he can get. So if people can get over to Bernie.org, please let me encourage you to do that. Back to you.
Very good, Tom. Thank you for that. I tried to get through when you mentioned earlier this week when you mentioned Lindsey Graham's insane call for a war with Iran, but I was glad to hear that your lines were too busy and I couldn't get through. I suggest we Eric Cantorize him. In other words, if he's so hot to start yet another war,
mm-hmm.
one that's obviously just another dead end, someone put the legislation forward and say, fine, have your war, Mr. Graham, but we won't do it unless we can fund it with increased taxes to pay for it, pay as you go, increasing the taxes on the millionaires and billionaires who will benefit from the oil.
Right. Is Lindsey Graham the senator from North Carolina, South Carolina?
Yes.
One or the other.
I
can never keep the Carolinas straight. But
it hardly matters. But
well,
I would just suggest, you know, a little dose of their own medicine is in order.
Yeah, well, what I was going to suggest is let Lindsey Graham have his war, but let's pay for it with a tax on this on South Carolina, on the good citizens of his state. You know, let them pay
sure.
for their citizens.
See
for
how
their...
that flies next November with his constituents.
Yeah, right. There you go. Gene, thanks a lot for the call. Harry in California. Hey, Harry, what's up?
Hey, thank you. For Ronald Reagan got voters to vote against their best interests.
Yeah.
And with the advent of getting rid of PBS, we have people who don't know what their best interests in. So the poor people don't know it's in their best interest to vote for social programs. And my comment is to PBS has just been proposed to be unfunded.
Right.
Let's go back to the fairness in
the fairness
the
doctrine.
FTC.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that should be one of our primary things, because without information, none of this is going to do any good.
Yeah, well, that's a small piece of it. The other piece of it is at the national level is to start enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act that Reagan stopped enforcing in 82 and break up the big giant media monopolies, the newspaper ones, the television ones, the radio ones, the cable ones, right on through the board. Harry, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls and possibly a report from Talk Radio News right after this. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So, I don't think it's a holiday for either one of us, but happy holidays. And,
thank you.
And what's going on in the world?
Well, I've just left the White House press briefing with Jay Carney, which is ongoing, in which the questions began as they went on about the killing today of Anwar al-Awlaki, the radical American-born cleric and American citizen who was apparently a leading figure in al-Qaeda's affiliate in Yemen, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The questions revolving around primarily the question of targeting and killing an American citizen.
Right. Without a judicial proceeding. The question I'm asking is, if they had so much evidence that this guy was a genuine bad guy, why didn't they hold a trial, convict him in absentia, sentence him to death in absentia, and then go kill him?
Exactly. Well, that question was asked along with a series of others. Jay Carney flatly refused to answer any questions regarding the circumstances of his death, said he would not address those at all. He simply talked about how, you know, basically it was a good thing that he was dead, that he was not only an inspirational leader to al-Qaeda, he was an operational leader, talked about some of the plots that he had been involved in. The only time where he gave us a hint, and I don't know who picked up on this, where he refused to again answer questions about the specific circumstances, but he then went on to say, we cooperate with our partners around the world. That effort continues. And he said that sentence straight after saying, I will not talk about the circumstances of his death. I thought that was interesting. Because I think that that was a sequence. Because it said to me that there probably was some cooperation with partners around the world, and he didn't want to involve them at all. That was part of it. He would not state whether the president gave a direct order for al-Awlaki's death. He did state that John Brennan, the counterterrorism advisor, notified him of the death very early this morning. But that was also interesting that he would not make that statement.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't. He said, I'm not going to acknowledge, concede, or accept premises embedded in questions. That was in response to a question about constitutionally the possibility of killing an American citizen.
Right, because arguably our Constitution allows American citizens to be killed. But it has to, the order to do so has to come from one branch of government, the judiciary, and then be carried out by another branch of government, the executive. And it has to be done in accordance with rules made by the third branch of government, the legislative. And I'm not aware of, you know, I'm aware of rules made by the legislative, but I'm not aware of any judicial process that led to this execution. Are you aware of any whatsoever, or perhaps a military judicial process?
I'm not aware of any judicial process. Nobody seems to be aware of any judicial process, and Jay Carney will not speak about any of the circumstances of his death whatsoever.
Wow, I can just hear Michael Savage going off on this afternoon. You know, the president can now kill any American he wants. All he has to do is decide that he's going to do it.
Yeah.
And there's actually possibly some bizarre and scary truth to that.
Very interesting, really quite fascinating that a president who's taking extremely strong stand against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is, it is believed, responsible for plotting the attack, the underwear bomber in 2009,
right.
The attempt on the cargo planes in 2010, inspired the attempted Times Square bomber.
There's no doubt he's a bad guy, but it's like you look at all these laws that have been made that allow us to be snooped on the internet. that were made in the name of protecting us from protecting children from child pornography or, you know, whatever. And, you know, who's going to stand up in favor of that, right? And here, and so we get these precedents that are established to stop a genuinely bad guy, a child pornographer, or a genuinely bad guy, a terrorist, but they can be used for anything. And that concerns me.
Yeah, it's very interesting. When he refused to answer any questions, there was just that one sentence that I've relayed to you.
Yeah.
I don't know
and
how
by,
widely
and
when, that will
and,
be
and in that one sentence, he referred to our allies. Does that mean now this was in Yemen that he was killed, right?
That's correct, in Yemen, part of Yemen that's really pretty lawless.
Now, does that mean that we are cooperating with the president of Yemen? I'm forgetting his name right now.
Yes, Saleh. Well,
Saleh,
it's very interesting.
Who is murdering his own people?
Yes. Now, Carney called on Saleh to continue or to start, actually, the transition towards getting out. He did call on him to do that, but at the same time, he said that we are basically cooperating with that government on counterterrorism issues.
Well, as long as they're a legitimate government, you pretty much have to.
Correct.
So I can actually understand that. But, you know, that's very interesting. I find fascinating that our president, our government is saying to this guy, leave office. We're opposing your government. By the way, we'll also work with you as long as you're in government. It seems like a very pragmatic and intellectually honest position, even though it may seem at the, you know, at some certain level hypocritical, but I think not. Anyway, what else is going on in the news?
A report released today by the Special Inspector General for TARP says that U.S. regulators moved too quickly to allow Bank of America and Citigroup and Wells Fargo to repay their troubled asset relief program bailouts. Basically, they pressured regulators to quickly approve their exit schemes because they didn't want to have restrictions on executive pay.
Right. So they got out of TARP while they were still unstable, so that they could pay themselves hundreds of millions or billions of dollars.
That seems to be correct. There are documents supporting that. And interestingly, Moody's downgraded three of them last week.
Wow. And Sheila Blair, by the way, God bless her, had opposed their getting out of TARP.
Yes.
Fascinating. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you in the third hour of our program. Mayor Bloomberg doesn't get it. Of course, he's a billionaire. And so, I he may have a little of a hard time empathizing with the average American who is screwed. Students who now have more student debt than all the credit card debt in America combined. It's exceeded $1 trillion for the first time in the history of our nation. Because throughout the history of our nation, basically, if you wanted to go to college, you could do it. You could work summer jobs, things like that. Well, not over the last 30 years. Reaganomics pretty much destroyed that. And older people are screwed, too. They thought that their house was their retirement. They used it as an ATM machine, and then they saw its value collapse. Why? Not because of some guy making $80,000 a year on Wall Street, but because of the institutions. Because of the billionaires on Wall Street, because of the people who have lobbied for these institutions. People are in New York City right now occupying Wall Street in opposition to the institutions and frankly, I would say criminal conspiracies. And they would have been criminal under laws prior to 2000. Criminal conspiracies, or at least. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a crime if it's against the law. Right at the moment, it's not against the law. It should be. In New York City, on Wall Street, to basically turn the stock market into a casino. When that's not what it was intended to be, it's not what it should be. But here's Mayor Bloomberg. He was asked on a radio program yesterday, apparently, or this morning, John Gambling's show. He was asked, what do you think about Zuccotti Park and the protesters? How do you end that thing? And here's what Mayor Bloomberg had to the billionaire mayor from New York who spent, I think it was $77 per vote to get himself elected last time. Here's what he had to say.
The protesters are protesting against people who make $40,000 to $50,000 a year and are struggling to make ends meet. That's the bottom line. Those are the people that work on Wall Street or in the finance sector.
Yeah, well, maybe the secretary at the front office, maybe the couriers, but the actual average starting pay, if Think Progress's research is to be believed, and they've got links back to the sources of this, the median salary for stockbrokers is $88,000 a year, which ain't chicken feed. And the average salary of the top 10 hedge fund managers on Wall Street, $2 billion a year each. And that's salary, income. If they took it as salary, they'd have to pay income taxes on it. Instead, they take it as a variation on long-term capital gains or carry forward interest. They've got all these little games where they pay a maximum 15% income tax on it. So Mayor Bloomberg, wake up and support the protesters on Wall Street. You have a corrupt system in your city. I realize you're a billionaire, but hey, you're a billionaire. You don't need their money the way some politicians do. You should be able to tell the truth and call these guys out. Eileen in Oklahoma. Hey, Eileen, what's up?
Hey, how are you doing?
Great.
My question basically is why the media blackout? I've called lots of people, friends, family in all different parts of the nation, California, Nevada, Arizona, New York, even here in Oklahoma, they don't know what's going on. They haven't had one word of what's going on out there.
Right.
And
if you go to theyrule.net and put in any of the big media companies and any of the big banks, you will discover that they all share common boards of directors. We are ruled in this country by and large by an oligarchy. The conference board, the group of the 100 CEOs of the 100 largest corporations in America, they get together, they're buddies, they hang out together, their families know each other. There really is an oligarchy in America. And this is not some wild conspiracy theory. It's actually fairly easily demonstrated. And, there's a very, very much a one hand scratches the other thing. You will not hear much discussion of this in the corporate media. It's just a reality because the corporate media and Wall Street are in bed with each other. And a lot of politicians are being funded by Wall Street. And if they're not funded by Wall Street, they're terrified of Wall Street. And so they're not talking about it. So that's the bottom line. And the way that we get around that, Eileen, is doing exactly what you're doing. And that is calling all your friends and telling them about it and finding sources on the Internet where you can wake them up. Tell them to go to BuzzFlash.com, TruthOut.org, CommonDreams.org, DemocraticUnderground.com, the list Alternate.org. I'm not so hot on the Huffington Post anymore. ThinkProgress.org, TruthOut I mentioned, MediaMatters.org, a great resource. The Daily Kos, DailyKos.com. There's no shortage of places where you can get this information and share it with other people. Do so, and it goes viral. Sharon in Michigan. Hey, Sharon, what's up? Sharon, you
hey,
are
Tom.
On the air.
I wanted to call and talk about the defense contractors in the country.
Okay.
But first, shame on Mayor Bloomberg. Just shame on him.
Yeah, I
thought what I don't think is being addressed enough or pointed out enough is the defense contractors, what's going on is just like they've made, healthcare a business for profit, they're turning prisons into a business profit, which is scaring me because I worked in the prison system as a correction officer for 27 years, and I just can't believe that they want to turn prisons into a business for profit. You won't be able to go to the grocery store without getting arrested for something.
Yep.
But now they have turned war into a big business for big profit with these defense contractors. And them doing that, Tom, will never stop. We will never stop these wars. Like, I think it was your show last night. I said, we have 150 missiles directed at Pakistan right now.
Right.
As long as they're going to be able to be billionaires off of war, they're just going to keep it up. And everybody in the world is going to hate America's guts and the attacks on us, these terrorist attacks. They're never going to stop.
Yeah, I am absolutely with you. Jacob, can you easily pull up that Franklin Roosevelt clip? It was in the middle. I think it was the third piece where he said, we will not have millionaires made out of this war effort. I mean, there was a time, Sharon, in this country where we understood that that was wrong. That whole idea of millionaires being made out of war, that, you know, war millionaires, was just a wrong thing. And in fact, Harry Truman came forward in the United States Congress when he was a member of the Senate, and he said, we should not have war millionaires. And he created a committee, Congress created a committee to look into war profiteering. Harry Truman led the charge in the investigations. Here is the kind of talk from the 1930s or early 1940s that led to it. Here's the President of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt.
Our present emergency and a common sense of decency make it imperative that no new group of war millionaires shall come into being in this nation as a result of the struggles abroad. The American people will not relish the idea of any American citizen growing rich and fat in an emergency of blood and slaughter and human suffering.
Can you imagine if President Obama said that? I mean, he would have so many people behind his back.
What happened?
With him.
What happened to where now it's perfectly okay for the Halliburtons and the KBRs and the Blackwater to where they can actually go in there and...
What happened was Ronald Reagan came along and said government is bad. If government is bad, anything government does is bad, including even the military stuff, and so you've got to outsource it to private corporations. And then George Bush put that on steroids and used those private corporations to start and occupy these two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, where in both cases, there are more private contractors in those countries at $1 million a person per year than there are U.S. soldiers. That's what happened. We had a culture shift, and we need to recalibrate our culture.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more of your calls here on Anything Goes Friday, 15 minutes past the hour. Any topic you'd like.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Anything goes Friday. Tom Hartman here with you. Paul in Kentucky. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Good Friday to you.
Thank you, and to you too.
And greetings from a fellow Firesign Theater fan, and I would hope that you could get them on again sometime, because I'd like to talk about your car. It's screaming, wash me, please.
There you go. Oh, one of these days, Phil Proctor and the Merry Band will be wandering through Washington, D.C., and we'll throw them in the studio again.
I hope so, and you can catch them on YouTube. And
yes, of course. And they have a new album out, you know.
Oh, they do?
Yeah. It's. I don't know their website. I'm assuming it's firesigntheater.com, but I'm sure you can Google it. And it was a few months ago they were doing a bunch of live theater stuff. I don't know if they still are, but I'm sure I'll hear from Phil or others, and I'll let you know. But like I said, you know, just Toss Fire, and for those of you who don't know what Paul and I are talking about, Toss Firesign Theater into your favorite search engine. You're going to love it.
Oh, yeah.
It is firesigntheater.com, by the way. SIGN Theater, Firesign. Yeah.
Oh,
so
great.
Anyhow, but the topic of your call.
Okay, the taking apart of the EPA.
Yes, sir.
It's time for the Democrats to use the fear factor that the Republicans have used. Here's what your world would look like if the EPA were gone tomorrow. Do some dramatic graphic ads, that sort of thing. Our local congressman is having a town hall meeting and public picnic tomorrow, and that is the topic. Basically, it's focusing on the EPA coal regulations and jobs in the Western Kentucky area, which is the heart of, if you think Eastern Kentucky is bad, It's like the surface of the moon in many areas around here, and it's not called mountaintop removal. It's called strip mining, which is an appropriate term for it. They just strip the topsoil off, and they leave it. He says, quote, with Kentucky's unemployment rate at 9.5%, I'm particularly concerned about proposed EPA regulations that could have a heavy impact on Kentucky's coal industry and the many jobs tied to it, jobs we desperately need.
Which slimy, bought-off son of a something or other congressman are you talking about?
This is Congressman Ed Whitfield.
Ed Whitfield. Republican or Democrat?
He's a Republican. Kentucky's first district. Unfortunately, in Kentucky, you can't tell the difference. It's kind of like Washington, especially when it comes to coal. And I think the only way that it can be dealt with is one thing. They need to retool, reschool, reboot, because these guys, they're willing to face black lung and give the rest of us black lung for what is a good salary, but they don't want to be out of work like anybody else.
Yeah, it's a human instinct. It's an absolutely human thing, and it's being exploited by these big corporations, and then they buy the politicians, they buy and sell these politicians, and you get politicians out there saying, like this bozo, who's not on the bus, is saying, it's absolutely tragic. It is absolutely tragic. The core issue here is getting money out of politics. It should be a crime for the coal companies to own a politician. And until we get back to that, you know, what was the essence of the 1907 Tillman Act that Teddy Roosevelt pushed through that said that if a corporation in any way helped a politician or gave money to a politician, the executives of that corporation went to prison. We need to get back to that Tillman Act mentality and legality in the United States. And of course, the Supreme Court keeps knocking these things down, which is another reason why it's so important that, you know, we're going to have a couple of Supreme Court vacancies come open in the next 5 years. It's so important that there be a Democrat in the White House to appoint a decent person to the Supreme Court. Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, excellent, beginning point, excellent starting point. But anyway, Paul, thank you for the call. Very, very well said. Sam, speaking of West Virginia. Hey, Sam, what's up?
Hey, I do not want to rant. I want to have a rational conversation.
Oh, good. You're not going to swear on the air today. Thank you.
Now, wait a minute. You did it before, but listen. Mark Twain said you can control that if you really want to.
You can. You can.
And
you won't go blind.
Like, you know, it's a wonderful life. We're living in Pottersville, and it's not marijuana Pottersville.
Yeah.
And my dad, who's in the Air Force for 26 years, told me there was international law, U.S. constitutional law, and then there's no law places in the world.
Yep.
And he got these catalogs where he ordered stuff for his Army surplus store. And, oh, gosh, me and him's not been talking now for a couple months because of politics. And my son, I'm stuck in the middle here. I tell you what, the country is becoming divided.
That's sad, Sam. Let me encourage you to reach out to your father and your son beyond politics, because even if you disagree on politics, my dad was a Republican until the day he died, but neither one of us ever let it get between the fact that we loved each other. And
can I mention one more thing?
Yeah, go for it.
A while back, I was talking about Mark Twain. Yeah. All right, he was sent on a mission back in the 1800s.
I'm listening.
Okay, and he did a book called Innocents Abroad, and that's when even the U.S. Army was taking on camels instead of horses and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He had a very interesting view of the world. You know, maybe we could look into there.
Okay, all right. Yeah, Mark
I'm going to let you go there, brother.
Yeah, okay.
I like your tie, man. I like that for a headband.
Well, thank you, Sam. This tie is actually I got it at the a Metropolitan Museum, and it's from the 1600s. So,
I like it a lot.
It's a replica.
That's cool, man.
Thank you. Have a good one, Sam. It's always good to hear from you. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We will be back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday, any topic you want, from the Fed to mountaintop coal removal to my tie. Oh, my. And also, you can drop into our live chat room, which is running 24/7. Whenever you're listening to the show, there'll be someone in there at tomhartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And also up next, in addition to your calls, the good, the bad, and the some giant word, ugly, right after this. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very paralogically ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, Russell Simmons, or is it Simmons? Not sure. What does a multimillionaire hip-hop mogul like Russell Simmons have in common with billionaire hedge fund manager like Warren Buffett? They both want millionaires and billionaires to pay their fair share. Simmons has joined the chorus of wealthy Americans calling taxes to be raised on people like themselves. In an op-ed for The Global Grind, Simmons wrote, "For far too long in this country, we have allowed the rich to get richer and the poor to get poorer. I am asking the United States government to raise my taxes and not allow the Republicans to use this economic recession as an opportunity to strip the basic programs that protect our most vulnerable." Like Buffett, Simmons also noted that all of his employees pay more taxes than he does. "It's time to reverse the tide of this class warfare in America started by Republicans at the behest of their corporate donors." The bad. Maine Secretary of State Charles Summers. At the behest of the state's Republican Party, Summers is dabbling a little bit in voter intimidation. Last week, Summers sent a letter to 206 students at the University of Maine who are registered to vote in the state but still have driver's licenses from their home state, telling them that they are not in compliance with state laws and that they need to cancel their voter registration in Maine immediately. The list of names was given to Summers by, you guessed it, Maine's Republican Party chairman. Keeping young people from the polls, yet another way for Republicans to steal our democracy in 2012. And the very, very ugly, Pat Buchanan. While Buchanan has hidden most of his racist inclinations since becoming a contributor on MSNBC, every now and then they slip out, like yesterday. Buchanan said he agreed with Herman Cain's comments on how African Americans are brainwashed into voting for Democrats and went on to say, "The African American community has embraced great society liberalism, which has been devastating for the African American family. I admire Herman Cain. I think what he's saying is that they bought a lot of liberal propaganda on the liberal plantation." And I think he's right. The liberal plantation? Nice choice of wording there, Pat. I think someone's been listening a little too much to Rush Limbaugh lately, and that's very, very ugly. So, your calls, your thoughts here on Anything Goes Friday. Elizabeth in Massachusetts. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hi, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true of you.
I wanted to say I was going to speak of Roosevelt in the fireside chat.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of wish Roosevelt was here to see what's going on because he would be rather... I don't know, pissed off.
Yep.
And what I loved about Roosevelt is that he was disabled and he was able to, he was in office three. I mean, he was the only president who did that. And then they had
four terms, actually.
He was
reelected three times, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what an amazing person he was. And his wife was amazing as well.
Eleanor, yes.
But I'm saying, I wish... In this day and age, we had somebody like Roosevelt right now.
You know, Roosevelt was a product...
I've been watching your show, and you've been doing some commentary from him.
Yeah, Roosevelt, and thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you very much for your comments and for your thoughts. Roosevelt was a product of his time. He became who he was because the people demanded that he become who he was. And I'll tell you, Barack Obama will become the person that we demand he become. And as Bernie pointed out 2 hours ago... That transition, that transformation seems to be happening right now. But just in memory of Franklin Roosevelt and his fireside chats, and thanks for raising the opportunity, Elizabeth, I asked Jacob to pick out his favorite little clip from one of FDR's fireside chats. Here you are, Jacob Dean's favorite FDR, one of Jacob Dean's favorite FDR clips.
"We must make sure in all that we do that there be no breakdown or cancellation of any of the great social gains which we have made in these past years. We have carried on an offensive on a broad front against social and economic inequalities, against abuses which had made our society weak. That offensive should not now be broken down,
by the pincers movement are those who would use the present needs of physical military defense to destroy it.
There you go. And that was February 1940. So that was, you know, pretty rough time for the country, shall we say. And he was saying, do not let the present emergency be used by the Republicans to cut social programs. Jonathan in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Jonathan, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Great. What's up?
I also wanted to comment on FDR and his very marvelous comments on the war and people getting rich and fat because of what's going on in other countries.
Yes.
I also wanted to ask you, really, where is the vociferous voice of Barack Obama on the very same issues, and why do people play these left and right red and blue games, you know, to promote Democrats instead of Republicans when George W. Bush did the same thing, and now Barack Obama doesn't seem to have a very strong voice against the benefit of the military-industrial complex.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the military-industrial complex has become what, and thank you for your call, has become what Dwight Eisenhower predicted. And that's the horrible thing. In fact, Jacob, if you've got the Cross of Iron speech, you can easily pull up. This is from Dwight Eisenhower. This, you know, he warned us about this. And when you combine that with the Supreme Court handing power to giant corporations and all these lobbyists who are here in Washington, D.C. and all around the world, all around the country, what you have is just a horrible, horrible, I was going to say mess, but it goes way beyond that. It is the distortion. It is the destruction of democracy. I don't know how it's just very, very straightforward. And again, let me say, you are going to hear the rhetoric that you want to hear from our politicians when they hear enough from you. And that's 100% how it works. It works no other way. This is Dwight Eisenhower in 1954 when he was president of the United States, talking about the cost to us of maintaining a massive military machine and how that cost can be translated into wheat, schools, roads. Here he is.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
That actually was his warning in 1961 as he was at his farewell address. Jacob is going to dig around and find the Cross of Iron speech, because I know we've got it. No, I want you to hear it. It's so cool. But anyhow, Jeff in Portland. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom, longtime listener. Thanks for taking my call. A new survey shows that there's a big enthusiasm deficit amongst Democratic voters compared to the GOP concerning 2012. In my opinion, Tom, the two major wars going on are responsible for this, and I'm talking about the two different kinds of wars. The one is the endless Orwellian war on terror, which is waged in our name, and it's also a war on our civil liberties. You know, the only way we can win this war is when we stop fighting it.
Yeah.
In the meantime, it's used to keep us fearful, unquestioning, and compliant.
Yep. And I can tell you, I'm seeing the cycle come around again, because the exact same thing was going on in 1968 when Lyndon Johnson was seriously thinking of running for re-election. And then Bobby Kennedy and Teddy Kennedy both came out and said that they were going to launch primary challenges against him. And my recollection is right. I know that Bobby did. And eventually he backed down and said, no, he wasn't going to do it. And I think, though, that Obama is not going to back down. I think that he's going to go forward and change. And Lyndon Johnson was trying. He was trying to end the war in Vietnam, but Richard Nixon was sabotaging him by back channels. You've heard me play the audio of that, where the CIA discovered that Richard Nixon was talking to the Vietnamese and saying, just wait until my presidency, blow up Johnson. Anyhow, here's the Dwight Eisenhower speech.
The wealth and labor of all people, a wasting of strength that defies the American system or the Soviet system or any system to achieve true abundance and happiness for the peoples of this earth. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft
from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is 2 electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is 2 fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is, I repeat, the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
Humanity hanging from a cross of iron. The cost of one destroyer. All those bushels of wheat. I so long for politicians who could tell the truth. This guy was the sitting president of the United States. That was not a campaign speech.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And not only that, he was a Republican. Where are the Republicans with some integrity? Bring them back, please.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to my show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Jacob Dean, to our video producers, Chris Bryant, Eric Hamilton, and Jim Javinsky, to our phone screener, Julie Lule, and writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum of WYD, to everyone at the various companies that syndicate this program, Dial Global, Pacifica Radio, Free Speech TV on Dish Network and DirecTV, to all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and all the others around the country, to Mona Koshvi, to Dennis Trunoff, Don Rojas, and all the other great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to Rachel in Santa Fe, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, to Alan Ratner and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, Jay Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. And special thanks to Meredith for being our call screener today. Thank you, Meredith. Back to your calls and on a wide variety of topics. Gerald in North Dakota. Hey, Gerald, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I worked for a state prison that went for profit. And all of a sudden we were getting kids in there for roaches and paraphernalia with under 2 years. And while inside the prison, we could get them up to 20, 18 years. They were getting all kinds of sentences from inside the institution.
By misbehaving.
So once they get those kids in a profit prison, they can really milk it.
So the for-profit prison brings in a kid on a two-year charge because he had part of a marijuana cigarette joint or a roach clip or something like that, or a roach in his pocket, that being a fragment of a marijuana cigarette. And then once he's in the prison, he gets provoked by other prisoners or perhaps by the guards, gets in a fight. That fight becomes criminal assault. They hold a trial on the criminal assault. They add another 5 years to his sentence. Now he's in for 7 years. Over those 7 years, it's fairly easy to... Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yes, sir, and it really picked up after they went for profit.
That's very, very interesting. Gerald, thank you very much for sharing that with us and with our listeners and our viewers. That is a problem. That is a real problem. Tim in L.A. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Yeah, Tom. Back about 1991 or 92, I was a student in college in political science major, and I forced myself to listen to Rush Limbaugh every day just to kind of get an idea what the far right was thinking about. And back then is when he started using the term to about Social Security and other benefits that we get as citizens, veterans benefits, things like that, as entitlements. And I'm assuming it came from Frank Luntz. Anyway, you know, since then, that term entitlements has become, you know, pretty generic. And I think it's time we recognize the origin of that particular, you know, phrase or statement and stop calling them entitlements and start calling them benefits.
Yeah, or insurance payments or
yeah, I mean,
the return
the
of your
even,
of your investment, you know, of your money.
Yeah, the president even uses that word, and he uses it in kind of a derogatory tone. And it's time that, you know, I think people ought to kind of, you know, write him or write the White House and say, look, let's not use that term because it started with Rush Limbaugh. And there's no question about it. Hey, one other thing.
Yeah.
The speaking of, you know, the deficit and everything else, and you mentioned it was very appropriate lead into what I'm going to say, using Ike's discussion of how a jet bomber aircraft cost about 20 high schools and all that. Well, listen, there's a new class of aircraft carrier they're making. It's the Gerald R. Ford class. And the price tag on each one of these particular ships is $9 billion, and they want it. There's at the behest of Southcom and quarterbacked by that nutcase chase down in Florida, my former congresswoman, Ileana Ross Lettinen. Excuse me. They're going to install a carrier battle group in the Fourth Fleet. Now, I don't know about you, Tom, but I don't think we have any kind of threat coming from South America and Latin America or Mexico that warrants a $20 billion expenditure of a carrier battle group. Do you?
Well, if we get another Republican president and they decide to do like Ronald Reagan did, you know, against Nicaragua, anything is possible. But no, I don't see a threat coming from the South other than their incredible success, maybe causing us to. No, I don't see a threat. You're absolutely right. And excellent. You know, it's the military-industrial complex. It's out of control. Eisenhower spent the better part of his entire presidency railing against it. This was the guy who ran the military in World War II, who defeated Hitler in Europe, and you know, he knew it better than anybody else. Excellent point, Tim. Mark in Chicago. Minute to the end of the show, Mark. It's all yours.
Oh, okay, hi. I just wanted to say that I heard you say something about like a terrorist spiritual leader was killed without due process. That he was an American citizen, and therefore, and what's bad about it is that American citizens are being killed without due process. Well, I really don't accept the fact that only American citizens are entitled to due process. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I agree. In fact, I quoted the Fifth Amendment, which doesn't say citizens; it says persons. It says no person
exactly
should be
right.
deprived of life without due process of law. And
exactly right.
Yeah.
What people don't realize is that all these rights, you know, the rights of the accused and all that kind of thing, well, the purpose they have is to protect the innocent, not to let help terrorists get away with crimes. So
right.
If you're saying that, like, we're it's less important that foreigners not be wrongly accused, they're wrongly convicted. You know,
no,
what I mean?
My point is that innocence is determined by the judicial system in our government. We have three parts of government, and the judiciary's job is to determine guilt or innocence. The executive branch is, at least with a federal charge, the executive branch's job is to execute the, not literally, but, you know, to follow through on whatever the decision of the judiciary branch is. And so I don't know the answer to the question. And Jay Carney today in his press conference refused to answer the question whether there was any kind of judicial process that led to the assassination of an American citizen. And I'd like to know, frankly. Coming up Monday, I'll be broadcasting my show live from the Take Back the American Dream Conference here in Washington, D.C. I'll be talking with the people who are making the conference and making a difference. Dan Jones, Rebuild the Dream, United Steelworkers President Leo Girard, Justin Rubin of MoveOn.org, Robert Borisage, and more. So don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag your head. See you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.